the landscape has changed. The attention, the voice of those artists from the African continent and the African diaspora has been stronger. And I hope that 154 has made an impact in changing the narrative of artists from the continent.
Says Touria El Glaoui, founding director of the 154 Contemporary African Art Fair, which is held in London every year and which draws its name from the 54 countries that make up the African continent. This year, the fair will be entering its 10th edition. So it's a good moment to pause and reflect and ask you, Touria, what is art up to at 154 this year?
Well, it has been quite an amazing, you know, a journey from the moment we started in 2013 to today. You know, the landscape has changed. The attention, the voice of those artists from the African continent and the African diaspora has been stronger. And I hope that 154 has made an impact in changing the narrative of artists from the continent, you know, to the rest of the world. I think what we see today in this edition in London is probably our largest, you know, number of galleries to date, you know, presenting artists from Africa and the African diaspora. There's definitely a huge enthusiasm, you know, that we have, you know, observed over the years with regards to the appreciation, but also the curiosity and also, you know, the visibility, you know, of those artists belonging now to big collections or to be part of, like, you know, exhibition, institutional exhibitions. And I think this has been for us a real moment of reflection, you know, on how 154 could, you know, continue its role, but also continue to be relevant, knowing that we are also in a different now, you know, moment. I want to say in the history of contemporary art, you know, with more inclusion, more integrity, you know, more, I want to say diversity. I think that's what we really are looking forward to, you know, is having this moment where now there's a real moment of appreciation of those artists that didn't have a voice before.
And you see the appreciation also in the art market. I mean, if you look at the history of the taste in the last couple of years and how in auctions or in galleries, prices also have soared for African artists that are really on the map now, where the art market used to be more focused on Europe and North America.
Of course. So I think part of it is access, you know, like suddenly giving access to all this art that was not there before. And also I feel like the appreciation is, you know, for some artists extremely well, I want to say deserved, you know, because they've been at work, you know, for years and doing milestones with their work that, you know, a lot of Western artists probably have done or not done. But I mean, what I want people to remember, as much as the appreciation of the auction houses, you know, is there and is real, it's still so much to do. When an artist from the US, you know, is coming out of school, it's sometimes often as appreciated as an artist who has worked on the continent for 60 years, you know. So I want people to realize, yes, we talk a lot about African artists and, you know, artists from the African diaspora, but I also want them to realize the gap in comparison to Western canon or to American, you know, artists. And this is very important because, like, let's not confuse both. You know, the market is, you know, getting very excited about contemporary African artists, but compared to what other artists are making, you know, there's a long way to go.
Now, you yourself also come from an artistic family. You were born in 1974 in Casablanca, and your father was the Moroccan artist Hassan El Glaoui. How did your upbringing influence your professional choices later in life? And how was it for you growing up the daughter of an artist?
So there's two things. You know, I think growing up in Morocco in the 70s, early 80s, there was no infrastructure for art and cultural platforms, you know. So I guess my first art education came from my father. And at that time, you know, it was about him sharing his taste, you know, of art, you know, having his studio in our home. For me, didn't feel special when we were really young. But then when we started having friends and comparing parents' professional career, you know, we realized that we had a very unique setting in terms of not having a father that go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning, or having collectors coming to the house, or, you know, his exchange with galleries, unconsciously being stored, I want to say, in my brain somehow, somewhere, you know. And I think when I made those choices of choosing, you know, where I was going to study, you know, for example, I had the privilege to go study in the US from Morocco, but it was for me New York, you know, the art capital of the world. I was able to then, you know, because of his curiosity, his, I guess, his transfer of love for the art, trying to make my own taste, you know, go visit as much, you know, art as possible, because, I mean, growing up, we're a bit deprived of it. And I think maybe one of the most important parts of my father, I want to say, legacy to me is definitely his practice in general, like in front of our eyes, you know, as a children, us posing for him, us seeing friends and collectors coming to the house, galleries, you know, coming, picking up work, him not being ready to give the work, you know, all those things. But also later on, when I decided to make those choices of like creating, you know, an art fair and representing artists from the African continent, I was also very aware of maybe where the artists stand, you know, in this commercial business, and how can we be respectful of their work and talk about the commercial aspect of things, you know. So it gave me an insight, I want to say, on, you know, the life of an ecosystem, I want to say, what the gallery role was, what the art fair role was, what a curator role was, what a collector, you know, how this ecosystem worked. So I think I jumped from a professional career that was not in art at all to a career, you know, to create this fair. But there's things that seem very natural to me, you know, in terms of dealing with galleries, understanding this world better than if I had not been in it at all, you know. So I feel like it really helped me understand also how my father was successful in establishing himself internationally, having all those international visibility at the beginning of his career, which really helped, you know, creating his career in Morocco, but also, you know, giving him an international, you know, I want to say, collector base. And I think that's, I think, what created my understanding about what was missing with all those artists from the continent before I started the fair, that they didn't have that access, you know, to international visibility, international collection, being where, you know, the institutions were, having this dialogue, you know, with the international world.
However, your career did not start in the arts. You went into tech and finance first. What drew you into the art world after you had a career in finance?
So first of all, my link to Africa, which is very important. I know I was born and raised in Morocco, but the reality is like when you are privileged, you know, to have the chance to travel abroad, you know, from Morocco, you are often turned around Europe, the US. You don't really want to go discover Africa. So I think I owe a lot to my professional career in terms of, you know, this technology company called, you know, Cisco System, because I was a regional sales manager for Africa and Middle East. And that really made me discover the continent where I was coming from. I guess even if it was not at all into the industry of art, it was definitely an eye-opener of discovery for me, for being able to discover those artists, being able to be there, you know, to spend time locally, discover artistic scene, etc. I feel also my career in finance and tech was also a period of my life where I learned skills in terms of maybe building a business model, you know, what it meant to create a market that didn't exist of a certain, you know, component. And I think maybe my, I want to say, business acumen, you know, helped me develop, you know, this startup business, you know, when I started with the fair. I would say also that the point that I think, you know, really attracted me back to the art, I want to say, industry, was definitely supporting my father in his late age, you know, not in terms of helping him with his reputation, but I got myself more involved because he was getting slower in doing a lot of things. So I helped him organize a few exhibitions because he was more timid in terms of, you know, starting larger project, you know, because he was getting older. And I felt like, you know, giving him a hand on this, as I was living closer, I was living in Europe and I was coming to Morocco quite often, really kind of like make me really enjoy that moment. First of all, with that relationship with my father that I adored, but also to understand a bit more, you know, the dynamic of the art world. And even though I had this idea by visiting all those artists in Africa when I was working for Cisco, I was also very aware of how my father's journey was, you know, in terms of beginning to established artists, to, you know, his international, you know, appreciation in the market. And I felt like I could add something something, because I really was very, I want to say, conscious about what I was seeing on the continent was really good. What I didn't understand is why nobody was talking about it when I was crossing over, all those geographical boundaries. When I was living in London, when I worked in the US, it seems that those artists did not exist. I guess parallel into my father's, career and basically what was probably the missing link, for, artists based on the continent with no access to this international, contemporary art world was definitely something I've made, during my career, with my skills. And there's a moment where I said, I'm interested to develop this concept and understand how I can make a difference for those part of this geography that was a bit ignored.
The 154 Contemporary African Art Fair has become a significant platform for contemporary African art. Can you share a pivotal moment when you realized that such an event was needed to bridge the gap between African artists and global audiences?
I think it happened, really early on when I was preparing, the first edition of 154 in 2013, because I remember some events that were key where it made me realize how far off we were. So, for example, there was this full admiration about the Tate, Museum doing its first solo show for an African artist, and that was in 2013. So at that point, I was like, okay, there's no institutional shows in the UK that had concentrated one show, on African artists. So it was actually two artists at the same time. You had the solo show of Ibrahim El Salahi, and then you had a museum. It was called the Museum of African Art, and it was done, I think, by Pascal Martin Tailloux, which also did this huge installation, at the Tate. And this was the moment where they had an African committee, taking over acquisition, and they decided to make apparently their collection more global and include contemporary African artists into it. So it made me realize that until then, they didn't include African artists. And then I had the chance to talk also with the same institution to, at the time, the head curator, who for some reason and some surrounding of very good connection gave me the time for me to explain the project. And she also made me realize something that was very strong, because I knew about, making a fair. I knew that it was important for the commercial livelihood of those artists. But what I didn't realize, and she made me realize, is that it would be the first of them exhibiting, but the first of even them having a biography, written down in a catalog. She really made me understand that it was a huge responsibility, and whatever I was doing, I was have to do really well, because people will be looking at it and maybe take it as a reference. I think that particular moment was very key, because I also understood that it was very hard to find those artists online or find biographies or information on them. And I realized that my whole concept had to be shifted from just commercial to commercial and education at the same time, and be the best platform we could be to be their voice, not just thinking about, selling a booth or having a stand, but more about, yes, it's going to be their first presentation. Let's make it count. Let's make them visible and make sure that it is the best way we can do it for them.
That sounds great. It also is quite a responsibility, of course.
It's a huge responsibility.
For 10 years, it has been happening in London, mm-hmm. but 154 Contemporary African Art Fair has expanded to different continents, with now editions in New York and in Marrakesh. Can you tell us about the unique cultural dynamics and challenges of these diverse locations?
I don't want to compare London to New York, but I think New York was really also a choice that we make to accelerate this integration, and this inclusion of all those artists into the biggest collections, the institutions. And we chose New York as the same city as we chose London. We thought it was a cultural European hub, at the time. And for New York, we thought it was also one of the most important market of collectors. And I thought it was as important for that particular reason. Now, what we didn't realize, because I went very, very enthusiastic about it, because we had two amazing years in London where we did sold out of every show we were making, and obviously having an extremely strong interest in terms of what we were doing, but at the same time understanding that there was not enough of 154 to be everywhere and to give access in the US, etc. So We kind of, you know, went for New York for the same reason, thinking that they needed that visibility in New York. But what we didn't realize is also the different setting, you know, about the different histories, for example. We felt that like the history between the UK and Africa was much more stronger, but less heavy. While the history between the US and Africa, you have this whole slavery story that is a very different and a different, I want to say, engagement, you know, with your audience once you're there. When you talk about Black artists, you know, Black history is very different and has less, I want to say, negative weight, you know, in Europe compared to the US. So this concept was very, I mean, we knew about it, but we really lived it when we were there. But I feel that also what we gain by doing that is opening a platform to have those discussions, you know, what it meant to be a Black artist in the US, you know. And funny enough, those are platforms that didn't exist there too. And I was very, in a way, surprised because in one of our educational programs, we had Julie Méritou that you mentioned a bit earlier. And one of the panel of discussion, she basically said it with, it was a great group of panelists, but like, very high New Yorker based curators and institution. And one of the things she raised is like, we have to wait for a UK British company to come to the US to let us talk about what it meant to be a Black artist in the US. So for us, it was very open. Well, for them, it had a lot of connotations that they needed to address. And I think that was a very strong, I want to say, point. And I think another point was the collector base. So there's a very affluent, you know, Black collector base in the US, which is very rare for the rest, I think, of Europe. And the buying power is also very important. And I think their main interest is about Black artists. So I think we were able to extend our collector base to also this group of collectors that were very educated, very enthusiastic about their inheritance and heritage, you know, in general from Africa. So we felt that there was, you know, this need. And I mean, we went to New York when we were in 2015. And I know there's this very huge appreciation of African American artists now. But in 2015, it was not the case. So we also inherited about a lot of artists from African American descent that didn't have a platform. So our definition of the diaspora became a bigger one as well. I think Marrakesh was very important to us because it was about showcasing African artists back to Africa. And over the years, we also realized that the definition of Africa, you know, how the West Sea is it, you know, it's always about West Africa, Black Africa in many ways. Often you forget that it's not just all Black. You have North Africa, you have all the Arabic part, like Egypt, like Libya, Sudan, all those parts are often ignored. I think it was a very good balance to go back to have a point that was, I guess, balancing this misconception or, I want to say, invisible border between North Africa and the rest of Africa. But I have to say it became suddenly a much bigger also event in terms of audience, in terms of need, you know, for the city. So the event has a whole different experience because we are working with the city, with all the museums, with all the cultural platform. So I guess the discovery for our collectors who are coming to discover 154 Marrakesh is a really an in-situ discovery of artists, you know, practicing locally, but also a better understanding of Africa in general. And I think from an artist's point of view, it's definitely a very strong point for them to be back, you know, on the continent that is important to them. So I feel like we really had to be back. It's an idea that came to us really, and I say came to me because when I was doing my first business plan, you know, for the fair, I originally thought that this event should happen in Africa. But then talking to all the galleries, when I was doing a bit of market research, you know, the first thing they were all telling me is that locally the collector base was very weak and they needed to sell outside their countries. But I think the venues as well play a big role. You know, I think the language of those countries play a big role. So, for example, those are, I want to say, variables I didn't think about. But in a way, the venues are very different. So we're in this very iconic building in the UK, which is really old, grand, neoclassical. In New York for years, we've been in very urban style warehouses, some kind, in different areas of New York. And in Marrakesh, we're in this very very, very luxurious hotel. And I think it gives a grand image on the continent of seeing this art in this fantastic building. I think the language, the French language being spoken and the Arabic language being spoken, also attract a different audience of collectors of interest. You know, we have a lot of Arabic institution coming to Marrakech. We have also a lot of French collectors, Belgian collectors, because they feel connected to, you know, maybe buying in in French language. I mean, I don't know, but there's definitely this factor that I wish I had thought about, but I didn't. But that worked in our favor.
I can imagine how big the interest is in the US for African artists. How is it the other way around? How is the interest in Africa in African American art?
So it is a bit of a challenge. You know, you have big collectors that have collected those artists long before anybody else that people don't talk much about, because, I mean, there's also a different, I think, I want to say, understanding of being a collector in Africa and a collector, you know, in Europe or in the US. Often they love to be talked about. In Africa, there's this dimension about you doing it for yourself kind of a thing, or to support an artist, or to be, but there's definitely less of them, you know, so there's probably less of an interesting situation. What you also have to replace is that if you're a Nigerian collector in Nigeria, already, you know, you already have a huge country to cover in terms of your interests, you know, and your ecosystem. And I think, you know, even for you to think Pan-African is already a big thing, you know, because you have a huge continent to think about. But then going to another, you know, diaspora, you know, in another continent, it's a bit far-fetched unless you're a global collector of some kind, you know. But I think it's nothing different than, you know, a French collector starting with collection with French art, you know, or a German collector starting with German artists, you know, so you will have African collectors from a certain country starting, you know, to support their own art scene and then, you know, maybe increasing or not. But what we've learned as well in the past is that this 154, you know, story where we have galleries from Ghana coming to Marrakech to exhibit, you know, are certainly, you know, interested in representing other artists from Africa, you know. We also saw in Marrakech a lot of Moroccan collectors, you know, who were collecting only Moroccan art, suddenly with 154 opening their eyes to the rest of, you know, the African continent. And I think this is, you know, one of the, you know, the beautiful things about connection, exchange, you know, because you see those connection being, you know, integrated, you know, in the taste, but also about, you know, the discovery of another, you know, country, another, you know, another continent.
So it's not just about art, but it's also about dialogue and exchange. And you give a space to foster this dialogue. Can you tell us, is there a moment during the fair that you remember when you witnessed a particularly meaningful cultural exchange between artists, collectors, or audiences?
So I think we had the chance from early on to have Koyo Kuo, which was a huge curator from Cameroon. She's now the director of the Zeitz MoCA in South Africa. And she helped me put this program together.
By the way, no relation to me, although I have the same last name.
Oh, wait? Zeitz. Oh, really?
But I'm not related.
I saw that. But yeah. Then I was like a bit, and actually she, you know, thought it was important that in parallel of the fair, we had this educational program that it would add to, you know, the awareness of the visitors, but also there was so much to talk about. And I think in terms of our first program, you know, she had the chance to have Hans Ulrich, you know, talk to Otto Bong, which was a Nigerian artist, and he was interviewing her, you know, that just that moment, you know, made him choose her for another project in Art Basel, you know, for example, you know, where she did a performance for him. And then, you know, obviously there she met other very important people, and now she's everywhere, you know, multi-talented artist. I'm not saying she didn't deserve it, but, you know, that connection, that moment, you know, of meeting a great curator, you know, who had such an important role, thinking about her work, about her by interviewing her, you know, that he had her in mind for another project. I also had, you know, the first year, a lot of curators from the US, you know, from Seattle, from, you know, Chicago, And all those curators were telling me, you know what, you have very small budget, you know, and they were head curators of the African, you know, the African department, you know, of their museum. But for them, it was not even impossible to consider, you know, traveling to all those countries in Africa to even meet artists or decide on new, you know, artists to be able to actually, you know, do an exhibitions. And a lot of them told me that, you know, their future exhibitions, you know, that they had in Seattle with a group shows of artists, you know, they had met at 154, and part of seeing the work, but being able to discuss it with artists. And I think that's very important. And a core part of 154, I think today, is that the artists are still very proud to be part of 154. They really think of it as a, you know, a milestone in their journey, in their CV. And I think that also makes them want to be physically at 154. I think we're probably one of the art fairs that often, you know, have, I want to say 50 or 60 artists being present, you know, and we know how hard it is to get visas in Africa, you know, and having them being very physically there, you know, with us to explain their work, meet the audience, you know, is a very important part of the education, but also the engagement of, you know, the collectors with the gallery, with the artist.
Can you share some insights into your approach to fundraising, sponsorship, collaborations? I know you have great partners in some project. How do you go about that?
So first of all, it's been a very long journey. I think I'm starting to have great partners now. There's some that I had since the beginning. But unfortunately, you know, your usual suspect of people you think would be the perfect fit, you know, because they either have companies in Africa, they're based in the UK, you know, you see all those, you know, I want to say synchronization of like ideas happening, you know, because you're thinking, yes, they should, because they have clients in the UK, etc. I think every sponsor I was able to get was not one of my listed, you know, potential sponsor. However, what I did from early on in the beginning is really create an advisory board, you know, which was very important to me because during my entrepreneurial, I want to say, you know, journey, there's a lot of time where it's a very lonely journey. You know, you create something, but you have doubts. You don't know with who to bounce idea. I didn't have a partner, you know. And I think the idea of having a very interesting advisory board, you know, that can open doors, that can think with you when they're very good and really motivated by what you do, you know, they come up with ideas as well, you know, and they sometimes are very connected. That's the point of having, you know, the right people around. I don't have the magic technique yet for sponsoring. I wish I did, but it's one of my most challenging, I want to say, area, even though I'm doing well this year, but it's like from hero to zero. You start from the beginning every year.
You mentioned it's a full-time job. Do you have somebody on this full-time job? How big is your team?
So my team, with me, we 8 people. We've been running it for like almost 8 years with 5 people, just to let you know. I mean, we had a big change after the 8 years because we don't realize it. But when you have a core team that stays with you for 8 years, they know the project by heart. So you don't need 8 people, but 5 people was doing the job. But once, you know, I had to restructure that team who wanted to also explore other things, you know, with who we were still very, very connected, but they have different roles. You also realize that they were doing much more than one role, you know, they knew the, you know, they grew into the fair, into the 3 edition, and hiring more people to do their job was also more complex because we had 3 fairs, the rhythm was very high, you know, and people have to go into a very speedy, I want to say, peak, you know, stressful moment every fair, and it's a bit more difficult. But what happened, to be honest, is that over the celebration of our 10 years, we also had the chance to have an amazing, you know, consultant group looking into how we were running the fair, you know, over the 10 years and share with us their wisdom about how they would do it in another business that is not the art world, you know. And I think in the beginning, because of my lack of knowledge of running a fair, I tried to copy, you know, other models that were already existing. And I think that, you know, moment of workshop with those consultants really made me realize that there's jobs that are very similar that you can do together, you know, to be more efficient. And a lot of demands are made by those sponsors. It's almost if you need half a resources to manage them, because they expect a lot. They give you a lot, but they expect, a lot of in return, so you need to deliver on what you promised and make sure they're happy. So they sponsor the fair. So it's a bit about understanding, how also each big sponsor, when we have a contract for 3 years, requires in terms of time of a person, so it is a learning curve.
The whole world and the art world has undergone significant digital transformations in recent years, and especially fairs have been touched by this whole notion, how is the future going to look like for fairs? How can you say has technology influenced the way you curate exhibitions and engage with art enthusiasts both at the fair and beyond?
I think we had a very, as you say, strong moment of digital online that still, persists to exist today during the COVID, crisis. I think for us, it was very important because compared to maybe other art fairs, other art, other galleries, a lot of our names of galleries, but also artists were really new to the collector base, so in a way, it was very hard for us to continue to exist if people were stopping talking about us, So digital has been instrumental. And I think, partnering with a partner like Christie's really helped us, develop that part of the business, where they created an online platform for us, that was their part of sponsorship, I'll say, during those 2 years. I definitely think we've seen, that the social media aspect of things as well have played a huge role, from collectors when they were not able to travel to be able to contact artists, to discover they had more time to spend on social media, on Facebook, on Instagram, to discover artists, talk to them. Some have also acquired pieces during that time, indirect, from the artist. And I think this also is changing, I want to say, the game, because artists being based in Africa can now, still think of a career being based in Africa, like having access to the internet, being able to exchange email with collectors, with institution, has definitely, on that basis being a huge, changing factor. For us, to be honest, besides doing online fairs, when it came to, what can be seen online versus to physical, what we've realized really fast, and I want to say it because that was also a very important factor, is that when we became able to do a physical show, this online factor lost some interest, and I think I'm not saying that it will not, it's here to stay, because now you want to be able to maybe also have a choice to be online. You give them that access, they still want it, but there's this, factor about regrouping somewhere, meeting people, following each other's taste, talking about art, being able to say, oh, you're going to Marrakesh or going to New York or London, for a show, that is very special and unique. And I think art is really, I want to say, a bonding factor, and I think this is very important. We've seen also other things, we've seen the huge, I want to say, appreciation of NFTs, that I think we had to address as well as 154, and it really came also right after, this COVID experience, where NFT suddenly became a huge, possibility for digital artists, to be present. So I remember that going to that, inclusion, I wanted to show that African artists could do NFTs and have done NFTs. They had like a whole group of digital artists. But I really today think that, I want to say the social aspect, digital aspect is definitely about connection, between, Africa and the rest of the world. And I personally think that maybe in the future or near future, we will probably have our own commercial platform, to sell maybe artists who are not represented by galleries already, on a curated, commercial mini digital, exhibition, to help support, the local market as well. But I think there's nothing as, I want to say, important as seeing the art physically, you know. So I think this people still enjoy. I also heard, you know, from some of my sponsors who are very high, you know, I want to say luxury sponsors, that it is also the place where, you know, for positioning a product or art is probably the only place today, you know, art fairs where high net worth individuals still physically come. That the rest of, you know, maybe shopping is something they can service to something else. They do it online, but they still physically go see art shows, you know, art fairs. It is part of, you know, something that people are still enjoying to have that experience, you know, which is a real experience, not a, you know, a digital experience.
As a woman, as a leader in the art market, what advice would you give to young women who want to make a significant impact in the art world or any male-dominated field?
So there's two points that I think are necessary to make, but that don't really automatically like that they are made. You know, I understand the concept and why it's important to talk about women in leadership position. I'm sad that every time we do those very focused women, you know, panels or, you know, your woman in the art world, we kind of like, in a way, eliminate all the women that were before us. Like it's something I want to say new and that it never happened before. And I know a lot of women that have been in those role as head curator, you know, the Tate director is a woman, you know, there's a lot of women, you know, that are also in the art world. I personally had a woman team, you know, that surrounded me, you know, most of my journey with 154, that have been the most amazing, you know, woman experience team, you know, that I had. And I also, you know, have been in so many conferences and so many, you know, art fairs that, you know, I see a lot of women working in the art world. You know, it's true that in the higher position, you often have maybe a man. And I'm gonna say, maybe my understanding of it is that a lot of you know, those very important either big fairs like Art Basel or, you know, big galleries like Hauser, you know, like all those master organization are run like, you know, billion companies, you know, type of business. So often it's CEOs from other industries that they bring in, you know, to manage those fairs. And I think this is where we come to the fact that there's less women posting for those jobs, you know, and it's kind of like, I want to say, a similar experience than the other industries. It's not very different than, you know, what we experienced, you know, in tech or in finance. There's less women going through this. And I think part of it is because a lot of women choose family. They choose also to slow down when, you know, they engage and have children, and thinking that they might not be able to do both. You know, I personally feel like, you know, my advice to a young woman is to go for it, you know, to not think they can't reach those position, to work to create, you know, that ecosystem that works for them, that create those opportunities for them. But I feel like I'm dealing with a lot of women in the art world, you know, even in Middle East, you know, a lot of the art leading figures are all women, you know, rather than men. I personally think there's a lot of position where you still have male, you know, dominating very high position, but I also feel this is, you know, quite changing since people have underlined, you know, that significant problem. But it's really reflecting of the rest of the industries as well and the rest of you know, the working force.
Looking ahead, what are your aspirations for the 154 Contemporary African Art Fair now and your ongoing efforts to promote African contemporary art? Now, the next fair is going to be in October in
Yes, in
London.
London, so from the 12th to the 16th of October. So what I would love 154 to be, because I think it's been, you know, the voice of contemporary African, you know, artists and African diasporan artists when they were not included, they were not, you know, part of the narrative. And it was very important for this to happen. I think we're also evolving into a landscape that has changed. And for me, the most important thing with, you know, inspiration would be that 154 stays relevant. I think not being owned by a big group, or a big company makes us, very adaptable, and being able to reflect, really fast on, how to do it, and being able to change, quite fast. But I think what I would love it to be is that it's still a platform that is useful for a lot of artists to be on it, and also that, the respect, of course, but also for the younger generation who are, coming out of school with a whole different landscape. And it was very funny because when we had this 10-year anniversary, in London, we celebrated with a panel where we had, younger artists who came out of school, who are doing really well, and older artists, part of the panel, who had quite a struggle to actually, be where they were. And what was fantastic to hear was those artists coming out of all those UK, universities, always knew 154. They didn't. They came out, and this was one of their option. They could go anywhere. And I think the idea is, like, knowing that this is also a truth, that the landscape has changed, is like, how do you continue to have, a role that is relevant to the artists, from wherever they are, but that, they can still find a use, to 154. And I feel like we still have it because it's always been a platform of discovery. And this is, I think we just scratched the, the top of the iceberg in a way, when you think about Africa and what's being developed, on the continent right now. But it's, it's about to always be renewing, what we do, to really be aware and listen to what is needed, for us to continue to be relevant.
If time travel was real, where and to what time would you travel?
So I think the first one, knowing it's a very long period, would have been the Renaissance. But where in the Renaissance, I don't exactly know because it's quite a long period, but I'm sure it has been an extraordinary period of culture, of, transitioning from the Middle Ages to this period of creativity. But then again, I was thinking, would I want to be, part of this early century with Picasso and Modigliani and, all those people, conversing in Paris, for example, and being part of that, conversation, of the impressionist, and I mean, I know, like, it's a bit mixed, but I mean, I would have loved to be part of, what it meant to be an artist then, and maybe have a chance to sit down with some amazing people, from that time.
What is your most important tool?
It's not a physical tool, but I would say it's my team.
If you were an animal, what would it be?
Either a horse or a dog.
What game do you like to play?
I love team games, so I think tennis is one of them. I started playing paddle this summer as well, and I love the interaction, the competitiveness. I'm more into, having teams with me and playing against somebody else, or, exchanging, fighting a bit. This is a bit more the type of games I like.
What's your favorite color?
Based on what I wear, I would say black, but I have a very strong love for blue.
Do you have a recurring dream?
Not really.
Do you listen to music while you work?
Only to music that I don't know the words to. So it has to be very, could be classical, it could be, background music, but if I start knowing the songs, it's distracting.
Which topic would you like Weltkunst to devote an entire issue to?
The African continent, for sure.
And last question, can you share a wisdom?
I think definitely keep doing, stay in the action, and the intentions are important. Everything is solvable, like the biggest problem, if you deconstruct it, becomes solvable, in many ways.
Great. Thank you very much,
Thank you.
Julia. And thanks to Volkswagen Group Culture, our supporter of this podcast. We are happy to welcome you in person in our next podcast live event in cooperation with Volkswagen Group Culture, happening at Berlinische Galerie on September 21st and shedding a light on the artist Edvard Munch, who will be celebrated this fall with two major solo shows at Berlinische Galerie and Museum Barberini in Potsdam. Join us for that.